You can lose, but I know how you love to win. Break my damn down and pick me like a javelin. Whoa, you said we can't all be dumb.
But anyway, man, so anything to talk about, man, aside from the obvious?
No, I don't. I really have nothing. It was cool what you had to say, you know, that you want to talk a little bit about Lennon and Dimebag and how just like two significant powerhouses of music.
Yeah.
Such opposite ends of the spectrum musically, how they were taken from us on the same day. It's just fucking mind blowing.
December tragedies aside, man, the news story this morning that will probably turn out to be the deal of the century, I guess. Not since Michael Jackson purchased the Beatles catalog. Universal Music Group, one of, I guess, the three dominating names that are left in the music industry that basically controls the industry. And I know, like, it's not just media relating to cable news and newspapers in Hollywood. It's also in music where, you know, basically three companies pretty much control everything. Bob Dylan has sold his entire catalog to Universal.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
That's fucking enormous.
Yes.
Wow.
That means that, you know, the sacred, sad-eyed Lady of the Lowlands now has the possibility more than ever to be used in an Oreo cookie commercial. You know?
Well, remember when Jackson bought the Beatles, one of the first things he saw was Revolution in a Nike ad.
Yeah.
And that's huge.
Yeah,
you can definitely see
that.
Dylan. You can definitely see Dylan stuff being used in commercials now. Wow.
Yeah, man.
Did they say what the deal was worth?
$300 million.
Fucking Bob, man. What's he got? He doesn't have much time left on this rock, man. What's he gonna do with $300 million?
Well, I think like anybody else, because they're so late in their careers, and unfortunately, you know, life. Let's hope these people live into their 80s and 90s, man, you know, that have some sort of a long life beyond rock and roll. You know, I can't see Bob doing this stuff in his 80s and 90s, but I mean, even Sinatra retired before he was 80.
Yeah.
Wow,
that's huge news.
You know, but
wow.
I think, like, you know, if you look at, and I know it's not always accurate, but if you know, you kind of like, you know, how you could Google people's net worth.
Yeah.
And so you have a lot of the monsters, a lot of the giants like Paul McCartney, who like, you know, obviously surpasses the billion mark. You know, he's got billions. Somebody like Bruce Springsteen, who, you know, apparently, well, according to Google, is over 400 million.
Wow.
You know, so, I mean, artists of that caliber, if you look up Bob, it says his net worth is 200 million. Now, Bob has never sold albums. Bob's never had the revenue of huge, huge album sales. And Bob's always, you know, to a large degree has been, I don't say dependent on touring, but he never stopped touring. And a lot of his revenue must come from touring. Because
he's
you know, in more recent years, you know, licensing to commercials and things like that.
He's always got the songwriting thing, though, too. I mean, every time you hear All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix, Bob's getting paid.
Of course. Oh, yes.
I mean,
he's
pennies on the dollar, but
sure,
You know, his songwriting catalog, the songs that he's written, goes for fucking ever and ever and ever.
And that's not for nothing that he releases a bootleg series every 2 years. Every 2 years, November comes another big box set. So
wow,
you know, it's but you know, I mean, you'll see his songs now, you know, all over the place. Most probably commercials, movies,
fucking,
and TV shows, a lot of those Netflix type shows.
The times,
you know,
they are a changing in a fucking Starbucks.
Honestly,
commercial.
And I hate to say it, man, but I honestly don't think it was enough. I think he could have probably easily gotten $500 million.
Well,
you know,
he probably should have done. Here's what he probably should have done. He probably should have followed the likes of McCartney and Bowie, where they were selling off. You know, where they sold, how'd they do that? They sold like shares of their music or something like that. I mean, because those guys got rich off of it, super rich. And Bob has always been Bob, so he just didn't do it. I'm not sure exactly how they did that or what they did, but they turned around and, I don't know, McCartney's dad, I think, was involved in it, or father-in-law, his first father-in-law was involved with it.
Right.
And I don't even, I would have to look into it to see how they made their money, but I know Bowie followed suit, and they've made a fortune off of it. And Bob is just being Bob, and you know that's not his style. He's living, you know, I mean, he was probably living pretty well as it was, and now $300 million.
I'm sure he's living very well. You know, he's probably thinking in terms of the future, and he, you know, his great grandchildren will probably, you know, obviously be able to live very comfortably. And I guess maybe, I mean, he obviously doubled his fortune, more than doubled his fortune.
How many kids does he have? I know Jacob.
I don't know. I think he may have six or seven.
Wow.
Yeah. He's got quite a few, with quite a few women. I've never really gotten too much into Dylan's, you know, private life. But I guess at this point it's just like, all right, how do you sustain what you have? You know, your lifestyle, what you have, and what, you know, without having to sell things off or declare bankruptcy or whatever. You know, whatever happens, you just want to be able to leave the earth knowing that at least the next generation or two is going to live very comfortably.
Yeah.
You know, and also I think, you know, maybe it just kind of alleviates just having to, you know, his kids having to deal with all the bullshit of, well, what would dad have wanted? You know, that would he have wanted his music to be, you know, that where they won't, that they don't have to deal with not royalties, but they don't have to deal with like licensing and having to deal with all kinds of infighting between, you know, what they think their father would have wanted. And you don't have to deal with the Dylan estate, won't have to deal with all this shit. But I'll tell you what, man, Universal stands to make a fucking fortune, man, for, you know, an army of lifetimes, man, in terms of raping and plundering the Dylan catalog, which are obviously probably going to do, probably more so in sacrilegious ways than we can really ever imagine, man. But I guess on the plus side, it's going to introduce his music to like a whole new generation of kids, man, who pretty much missed the train, man. And you know, they're going to know his songs. You know, it's going to be a lot of, you know, hey, you know, like who sings that song in the hemorrhoid commercial? You know, what's that song? You know, what's that dude? You know, like, what's that song at the end of the that episode? You know, the Orange and the Black show or whatever that show is, man. You know, well, that's Bob Dylan. Well, who's he? You know, it's gonna be like that. You know, it's like, you know, kids know AC/DC and the Stones through video games. You know, like that you know, music. What's that, Rockstar and Guitar Hero?
Yeah.
You know, kids are learning music through that stuff. You know, and like they're not. You know, it used to be like a generation before where they had older brothers and sisters. We had, you know, in our case, maybe we were the older brother or we had an older brother or sister who listened to cool stuff, you know. And then another generation where their parents listened to Led Zeppelin or whatever. And now we've gotten so far from that that it's just like, you know, they have no connection to it, man. So they're being turned onto this music through things like Rock Band, Guitar Hero, are those two things even a thing anymore?
I don't think that they're games. I don't think that they're still making games, no.
Yeah, well, so I guess by all means, hand his music off to the future and just not have to deal with certain things, and he'll get like a nice. I still think he could have probably gotten 500 mil, but.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with that. Is you know, once he's gone, his family's not going to squabble over the remains of his estate. I think that's what it really boils down to.
Look at what the Zappas are dealing with, man. You know, all the bullshit between the Zappa kids, man. You know, who's suing or who's prohibiting who from using this name and that, you know, and all that kind
of Dweezil,
crap.
For the longest time, Dweezil wasn't allowed to he was doing like a Zappa show, and Ahmet and Moon like kind of sued him to stop using it. It was just a whole big fucking shit show, man.
Yeah,
that was a horrible fucking thing for them to go through, because his estate is pretty damn good. You know, his estate is pretty well off.
Yeah, and then you have estates like the Hendrix and the Marley estate, man. It just kind of basically just licenses his name and his images everywhere.
Very
and
protective.
Probably
Hendrix
make
back.
More money than, you know, the artist could ever have imagined.
The Hendrix estate is very protective of him. Very.
Mm-hmm.
They Howard, I think Howard Stern was talking about how he wanted to use something in his movie, and they turned him down because it was. I didn't think you had to hang up. All you had to do was hit merge call again, and it would have worked.
Oh, all right, yeah.
That's all right, though. It doesn't matter. That was very strange.
Yeah, it was weird. You just dropped out, but we were talking. You were in the middle of talking about the Hendrix estate and how they've handled Jimmy's affairs.
Yeah, but they turned Howard down from using it in his movie because of, you know, they're trying to shy away from Hendrix's music being attributed to drug use. But I mean, you know, back then that's what it was.
And the other thing I found kind of. I mean, it's kind of neither here nor there at this point, man. But, I mean, Universal is, you know, they're the ones that are responsible for the 2008 fire that destroyed a major chunk of the master recordings that exist all over the world of music. Dozens of artists lost their master tapes in that fire.
Movies
and it was covered up for a decade, man. It wasn't even known about until about 2 years ago. I don't know who broke the story in 2019, but I mean, it was this massive amount of music that no longer exists.
Yep. All the masters are gone. Guns N' Roses, I think, fell under that. They were one of the bands that fell under that. Like, they lost their original.
A lot of bands.
I think for Appetite. Yeah. I mean, I just singled them out because they're.
Yeah, no, they were definitely one of them.
Like, and the original recordings of Appetite is gone.
Yeah. I mean, it's like how certain bands that are just kind of like suffer from over remastering. Like, how many times is Zeppelin or the Beatles going to remaster their catalogs and re-release it? You know, like they do it every 3 years. But,
Jimmy Page gets a bug on his ass and he's like, let me re-record fucking, I don't know, everything.
Yeah.
That's his way of getting back at fucking Robert Plant for not touring, I'm imagining. Plant's smart for not doing it, though.
But, you know, I mean, I guess so like artists that have to remaster their catalog, they're going to have to do them from the digital. From the CD masters or something, I don't know. But, and so now Dylan has now handed over every song and recording he has ever done to Universal.
That's
and then there's, I guess there's the obvious of, I guess I spent enough time talking about December 8th, 1980, that even though I wanted to do something acknowledging the fact that this year is the 40th anniversary of when the world lost John Lennon, I figured, you know, the obvious thing would be to do something. And so everybody's going to be doing something. So I just assumed do nothing and just kind of let it pass. And, you know, don't make it the focal point of anything that we may decide to do in early December as a Rock Under Fire episode.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess early December has also been, you know, hasn't always been a good time for rock music.
And
not one, not two, not three, you know, but at least three, or, you know, at least four or five horrific events.
Right.
That, you know, at least since 1969 has seen this underlying sense of tragedy that goes through the early part of December. You know, I guess beginning, and I mean, with our lifetime, and we were born a year later, but Altamont happening, Altamont Speedway concert, Rolling Stones with
Hell's Angels,
and...
Well, I don't know, man. I'm sorry to chuckle about it because it's a bad thing to happen, but if I'm having a party or a big concert, don't think I'm going to call the Hell's Angels to run security for me.
Well, that's the first lesson learned. That's the first lesson.
I mean, isn't that obvious, though? I mean, I don't know.
I guess back then, maybe it wasn't.
Right.
Back then, you know, I guess they figured it was supposed to be Woodstock West.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
5 months after Woodstock, and it was September, October, November, December. Yeah, 4 months after Woodstock. And, you know, it was still peace and love. And they figured, well, they achieved this almost, you know, utopian... whatever, on the grass, on the hills, you know, Yazoo's farm, 300,000 people coexisting peacefully, you know, the shining city on the hill came to, it was fully realized for 3 days, and they thought that they were going to accomplish that again.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess what the Bible calls the dark night of the soul. Well, it didn't happen, man. They chased it, but it didn't happen, and it turned into a fucking nightmare. And I mean, I guess symbolically, and I'm tired of hearing about it, but symbolically, the end of the counterculture and the end of the 60s and all the rest of that shit, man, I think that far extends into the 70s. But nevertheless, it was a fucking disaster for so many other reasons, other than the fact that, you know, the Hell's Angels were there just doing what they did and just making everybody's lives miserable who came within, I don't know, 20 yards of that stage.
The concert footage of that is just wild. Just Mick, just be cool, man. Be cool. Just everybody cool. We're not going to keep playing. It was just wild watching that shit, man. That shit unfold was just insane.
It's scary, man. It's really scary if you think about it, where you just, I mean, first off, the movie's incredible. I mean, the movie, I found out, is just really, really cleverly edited to make the Stones really look good. Like, they weren't really at fault for what happened.
But
the Stones aren't totally at fault for what happened. Obviously, the Angels were, but, you know, Jerry Garcia, and, you know, the dead bailing, totally bailing, man, like getting the Hell's Angels there. And then they land and they find out, oh, they're beating everybody. Well, and they flew the hell out of there. They didn't even play.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, the stage was like 3 feet high off the ground. I mean, you know,
that's another thing, how low to the ground they were. Yeah, it's like playing in, like the fucking local pub. You know what I mean?
It looks like the OLP Church Battle of the Bands or something at the carnival.
Yeah. Yeah. Set up some plywood on some milk crates and just have a go at it.
They get off the stage, people are sitting on the stage, man. And then you just like look down the hill and you see the stage and it's like this little platform. That's the stage. Oh my God! You know, that was just pathetic. You just see people just like standing there watching them set up, and they're just kind of like looking at them. And it's, I don't know. It's just every time I look at footage of that, of the audience, like the first audience that got there, and they're watching people on the stage, and they're like, "Dude, get off the stage!" And it just reminds me of something that was like at OLP Carnival.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But, there was that, the fact that obviously the bad acid that was going around, and the fact that the wine, the really bad, cheap, headachey, hangover wine, man, you know, in combination with the bad acid, and it's just, it was, everybody was on a fucking bummer, man. The entire,
with the Angels, you could go as far as saying that some of those Angels guys were probably all fucking messed up too. You know, they're doing some of those guys are doing hardcore drugs, not just acid and wine. They were doing, you know, methamphetamine and shit like that. Man, they were all fucking jacked up.
The deal was, I don't know how many cases of beer that they were promised, man, but that's how they paid them. They paid them in beer. And, you know, obviously, and with the drugs that you mentioned, man, it just was the worst recipe for the most horrid shit that could possibly go down in a field of 800,000 people.
I don't think, I can't believe the state of California let that happen. Oh, we're going to have, I mean, the Hell's Angels at that point were already being investigated as an organization.
I think it just happened. It just happened. Like, everything happened in a matter of like under 2 weeks, where they just decided that this was going to happen.
Let's just throw it together. Like you said, the Our Lady of Peace Carnival.
You see the whole inner workings of the concert in the first like 20 minutes of the film,
right?
Where you got these bigwigs, man, in suits sitting in an office, and you know Mick Jagger has no idea any of this shit's gonna happen because these people are doing it for him. All they got to do is show up, be told where to go, and they fly the fuck out of London, or you know wherever they are in Britain, man, and come to San Francisco. All they did was get off a plane or a helicopter.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, right.
You know, but. You see the deal being made and nobody wants any part of it. And then they were like, well, what are we going to do for security? And who's going to come out there? And who's going to like, what the fuck are you guys thinking? You know?
Yep.
And then again, at the end, after the concert, man, you see Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts, man, sitting in the studio listening to the playback of the concert, man. And then again, they're kind of asking, like, you know, they don't directly ask it, but you know, they're thinking, like, what the fuck were we thinking? You know? Like, what what happened, man?
Maybe they were high, too.
Yeah, man. So Altamont, obviously, I guess the last big event musically in the 1960s. And then a few short months later, these two dudes, Pat and Mike, were born.
Yeah.
And
in the spring of 70.
Yeah. And Altamont, obviously, a year later, the film came out. So everything was kind of like, well, this murder happened. And everybody, you know, Rolling Stone obviously put out the article that put the blame on the Stones. And so by the time the film came out, almost a year later, you know, you got a chance to see the murder. You got a chance to see what happened and how it looked. But obviously it was edited, you know, in such a way as, you know, apparently, like, Meredith Hunter, like, when he died, he, you know, the film shows him being taken away in a helicopter on the side of the stage. Apparently that helicopter didn't arrive until, like, 6 hours later.
Oof.
You know, so he just laid there and bled to death, man, on the side of the stage while the Stones were playing, man. And apparently there was another helicopter. It was the Stones' personal helicopter, and they wouldn't let the kid get on the helicopter. Like, that was, like, for the band. And they basically just, like, he just died, you know. He just laid there dying, man, slowly while the Stones were playing. At some point, the body was actually placed on the stage, you know, which I didn't know until recently. You don't see that. You don't see that in the video footage, but apparently there are some pictures where there's like a scuffle in front of the stage, and where these bodies almost like piled on top of each other. And that was just after they had put Hunter's body on the stage. And then they immediately kind of just like pushed, you know, I don't know if it was one of the Hell's Angels or whatever it was, but again, pushed it off the stage, like, get that thing the fuck out of here, man.
Wow.
But you know, they knew what was going on. I don't think they knew that anybody had died until after. But if you look at probably the most impressionable thing, I mean, on me since I was a kid, the first time I saw Gimme Shelter, I was 8, and during Under My Thumb, when they're trying to get through Under My Thumb, and you see that one guy who's having the bad acid trip, and he's standing like a few feet away from Mick Jagger, you know the guy I'm talking about, man.
I do.
He's just like pulling at his beard, and he's pulling at his face, and he looks like he's ready to rip Mick Jagger apart.
He wanted to like eat Mick Jagger.
And he was having a baby on a total bad trip, and you could see if you look at Mick is like afraid to turn around and look at him, but he could kind of sense his presence. And you see Mick kind of like looking at him at the corner of his eyes, and he's trying to sing Under My Thumb. And you could hear Mick's voice shaking, man. Like, you could hear the fear, in his voice, man. And you could see the fear in his face.
Yeah,
you know,
that,
like,
he definitely saw that. Without a doubt.
It's priceless footage, man, but it's devastating. It's scary. It's like, oh my God, man. Like, the shit that could have gone down that night,
yeah,
you know,
there could have been an all-out riot.
You know, a lot of the speculation was, oh, maybe, you know, that he was pointing that gun at Mick, you know, or he was going to kill somebody in the band. A lot of people hated Mick Jagger. I mean, Mick Jagger had already, you know, in their eyes, had sold out. He stood for part of the establishment, man, and he was, you know, just this rich, filthy pig, man.
Yeah.
Who cared about nothing but himself, man. And he really took a beating, man, in the last part of the 60s by a lot of people that just kind of criticized the Stones. I mean, even like 5-6 years into their career, man, the Stones had already been accused of selling out, and they got old, man. Like, how dare these guys pushing their 30s still be playing rock and roll, you know? But, and then almost like 10 years to the week, The Who in Cincinnati, right?
Well, this one I don't know too much about because, no secret that I'm not really a big Who fan, and I don't know too much about this one. So
a lot of this one sticks out. I mean, a lot of it sticks out in childhood memory. I just remember, because I remember knowing about, obviously you and me were both very into rock and roll at a very early age. You know, we grew
right.
up, you know, very young. So by the time, and again, I remember watching Gimme Shelter, because PBS ran Gimme Shelter in the summer of 78 when, I guess when the Stones were doing, you know, their Some Girls tour. And
right.
I remember, like, I guess it was a year later. I was probably in fourth grade or something, but it was the same week, 10 years later, on December 3rd, 1979, 10 years after Altamont,
right.
That the Who were on tour, and it was their first tour without Keith Moon, Kenny Jones on drums, and they had kind of regrouped after a year of, you know, after Moon's death.
Right.
And it was still a general admission show, and it was freezing temperatures outside, and the upper level at Riverfront Coliseum in Cincinnati at the time is kind of like a, if you've ever gone up like in a parking garage, like the second level of a parking garage, like that just big concourse, man. Like, if you've ever been at Menlo Park Mall, where it looks out over Parsonage Road, if you're up in the, you know, outside of where the food court is, it's kind of like that. And it was just, you know, the whole concourse, the whole thing had just packed, was filled with people, and they only opened two doors.
Oh, wow.
And when two doors opened, man, everybody just kind of rushed, because people were freezing. That was the thing. It was just like, what the fuck, you know, let us in.
Yeah.
And it just got to the point where everybody surged forward. There were like these periods of stopping and then periods of surging forward where you were being lifted off your feet and the crowd was moving you. You weren't even walking. You know, that's from what a lot of people have said, with that when the surges were happening, a lot of people were basically lifted off their feet.
Oh,
and a bunch of kids went under. And if you went under, you couldn't pick yourself up, man, because now you had people stomping on you.
Right.
So 11 kids were trampled to death.
Jesus.
And it was, you know, a lot of them were very close to the doors. Only two doors open. I don't know how many doors there were, maybe six, eight. I don't know how many doors there were on this one side of Riverfront Coliseum, but, 11 kids died. It was a big news story for a couple of weeks.
So did the Who ended up playing their show that night?
They played the show that night because they had no idea what had happened. And
okay.
There's a tape of that show. It was a good show, you know. And then when they got off stage, Bill Kerbishley, who managed them, I guess Kerbishley, I don't know if it was Glenn Johns or it was Bill, probably Kerbishley, yeah. Told him, you know, make the encore quick. Something's happened. We gotta, there's been an accident, and we need to wrap the show up.
Wow.
So, and then they found that out. Now, the next night they went to Buffalo. They didn't halt anything. They just, you know, they just carried on, but they were obviously shaken. Never really got over it. They interviewed Townsend and Daltrey last year about it when they had the 40th anniversary of that whole thing. That's on YouTube also, where, you know, Daltrey went back after 40 years and he met with the parents of the kids.
Oh,
and
wow.
He went back to the high school and they dedicated, like, you know, he dedicated this big monument to the kids. It was really sad, really horrible thing.
Could you imagine being trampled to death?
I tried to envision it, man. It's nothing that it was. And it happened to Pearl Jam like 20 years later. Like,
yeah, I know.
When it happened in Europe with Pearl Jam, and that's pretty much how Townsend, I believe Townsend and Vedder first connected, man, when they first met each other. I think it was Townsend, because Vedder was very distraught over it, man.
Yeah, he was.
Fucked him up. And I think it was Townsend who contacted Vedder and said, look, you know, like, I know what you're going through, man. this happened to me, you know, this happened to me once, you know, and I don't know. I don't know that that's how Townsend, if that's the first time that Townsend and Vedder ever talked, but I would imagine it might, you know, might be, you know, because it was still pretty early in Pearl Jam's career. It happened in like the year 2000, you know, that Pearl Jam was basically just under 10 years into their career at that point.
He's a big Who fan.
Yeah, definitely. Big time. And then, of course, a year later, man, a year later is, you know, 1980. And on a smaller, you know, on a much smaller footnote, and, you know, I don't know if this doesn't insult or disparage anything in terms of punk, but the Germs, a guy named Darby Crash, dies on December 8th. But also on December 8th, now that's obviously the smaller name that always gets overshadowed by John Lennon.
Yeah.
But, you know, Darby Crash of the Germs did die on December 8th, the same day that John Lennon died. John Lennon is obviously the one that kind of stopped the world.
Yeah.
For a few weeks.
Monday Night Football, the whole nine yards.
What was your experience with that? Did you say you were in the car for that?
I was in the car for John Belushi. I was home, and my mom was sad about it. And then I just remember it being on ABC News, and it was like the whole story about it, and everybody gathering at the park, and you know all everything that came with it. But I remember where I was living at the time in New York, and it was, you know, my mom was a big Lennon fan, and probably more so than the Beatles. I mean, she enjoyed the Beatles too, but she was a huge Lennon fan. To, you know, there's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. She was pretty distraught over it. Yeah, we were living in this little town in upstate New York. Was it Hurleyville? It was either Hurleyville or South Fallsburg. They bordered each other, and we're in this little apartment. Two-bedroom apartment, me and my brother and my mom. And like I said, I remember it vividly. ABC News. Always been into ABC News. I still am as an adult, which is very strange.
If I have to choose between the three, I usually put on ABC if I have to watch the news. ABC was always kind of on in my house. And it's kind of just like the sound of childhood.
Yeah. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Fair.
News, you know, like the music, like the 6 o'clock news,
yeah.
You know, and you're just finishing up dinner, and then the news is on in the background, and you hear that Eyewitness News music, and Bill Butel or like Roger Grimsby,
yeah.
Or something, not Bill Butel,
yeah.
But you know, Roger Grimsby was always on.
Well, Butel was, I think, eventually on ABC, wasn't he?
I don't know. I was thinking of Roger Grimsby though, but
yeah.
I remember, obviously, my memories of it are very, very sharp, very vivid, still right there to this day, to the point where I've said many times, it was one of the reasons that I wrote the book, you know, is hoping as some sort of a personal exorcism. And I know that's kind of become a cliche as to why writers often create things, you know. Because certain things that just don't go away, man. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, obviously I wasn't really, I knew who the Beatles were. And I didn't know how important he was, but I knew something bad had happened, man.
Right.
Because all the adults were crying. And
yeah,
you know,
there was
it's like one of the more profound things that Bruce Springsteen ever said to his audience was, you know, when he used to witness his neighbors, the domestic disputes between his neighbors and this guy beating on his wife. And, you know, he said, well, one of the scariest things that when you're a kid is when you hear grown-ups arguing. Because, you know, when you're in your house, in the safety of your house, man, and you hear two adults, man, who are supposed to be these the people that keep you safe, and they're fucking coming apart at the seams, man. Your house is your world, and that can make the whole world seem very unsafe. And that made me think of, it made me realize what was really scary about the whole Lennon thing initially as a kid is was seeing grown-ups crying.
Yeah.
Seeing adults crying. Why are the adults crying? Why was the art teacher crying? Why was the babysitter crying? What's like? What happened? Something really bad happened. What's going on? You know. And that was in my initial. That was my initial thing. And
my biggest thing is seeing all the people gathering in the park and singing and candlelight vigils and stuff like that. It was really wild, man.
Yeah, I remember my fifth grade teacher, you know, talking about John Lennon the next day, and she talked about him like almost every day that week. Like you can tell she was bothered by it.
Right.
You could tell she wasn't one of the ones crying, but you could tell that she needed to talk about it.
Yeah,
you know, and it's like, and she talked about this song called Give Peace a Chance. And she was like, does any of your parents have Give Peace a Chance? I would think that maybe it was hard to find back then because it wasn't really on any album.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was later on Shaped Fish, but it may have been on that album. But I guess she wasn't a record collector. So she was just like, oh, this song, you know, and it's a rare song. If anybody has it, can you please bring it in? You know, and somebody brought it in and we listened to it. I just remember that, you know, and just kind of remember the vigil on TV. I remember for whatever reason, it was some family event. It was on a Sunday and we were all at my grandparents' house. And I remember they weren't Beatles fans, man. They weren't really Beatles fans. I for whatever reason, the whole living room got quiet, like silence, man. When they had the moment of silence, and I remember it was a whole 10 minutes of silence. It wasn't a moment of silence. It was 10 fucking minutes, man. And I remember that 10 minutes, man. I remember just sitting and everybody in the room, and there had to be like 12 of us, 15 of us, man. It was a lot. Like aunts, uncles, cousins were over. And we just...
It was around the holidays.
We were staring at the TV.
Yeah.
And it told me, like this is big. You know, I kept thinking, like, this is big. Like, this, like I've never seen anything like that, man. And that kind of always haunted me as I grew up. And then when I got into the Beatles, like, just after high school graduation, man, I was 18, you know, and kind of got into the Beatles over the next year, man, and realized the importance of Lennon, man. And I just remember going to see Imagine when it came out in the fall of 88, like, Imagine in the uh-huh. movie theater.
Yeah,
you know, and just watching the movie, and then obviously, you know, again, like the Titanic, you know how it ends. You know John
right.
Lennon's going to get shot in the end, and then it went back to the vigil, and you seeing these people crying in the vigil, like basically, and seeing that footage for the first time that since it happened, since I was a kid, you know, and just breaking down in the theater, man, as the credits were going up, you know.
Wow. Yeah.
Just fucking breaking down, losing it, and sitting there hiding my face because I was ashamed because all my fucking stoner friends were around me, man. You know? And I hear songs like Starting Over, man, and just some of those songs from Double Fantasy, man. It just fucking puts me right back there, man. And with, you know, a lot of the feeling of what was going on back then, you know? It was just a very vivid period of a lot of stuff that was going on with me as a kid, man. I remember one of the reasons I remember a lot of this is because I cracked my fucking head open on a playground field playing kickball a couple of days before, and I had to go to the middle school at night the same night to get a soccer award. So yeah, these are the things that kind of stick with you, man.
Yeah.
December 8th, which I guess before John Lennon was killed, and a lot, you know, to a large degree, man, to a lot of people that still attribute that also, you know, and rightfully so, just attribute December 8th to Darby Crash. December 8th was kind of known as Jim Morrison's birthday up until that point in time, you know. And it was no longer just known as Jim Morrison's birthday after 1980. And then two decades later, December 8th also became synonymous with Dimebag, you know?
Yeah. And, it's, you know, and I can remember when that happened. I was like, wait a fucking second. Are you kidding me? This is fucking the anniversary of Lennon's death. And as much as, you know, as much as Yoko had to sit there and, you know, and realize what had happened to her husband, you're on the stage with your brother talking about Vinny, his, you know, Brian Baker's brother.
Yeah.
And watch your brother get murdered on a fucking stage doing what you love. I was just blown away by it. I'm like, what? And you don't even have to be a Pantera fan to realize that. I mean, it's just, that's a human, you know, that's human life. I mean, I don't even know what I would do if I witnessed that, man. I don't know. People are fucking sick, man. I you know. Yeah. I don't know. I have heroes, man, and people that I look up to, but what kind of sick individual is like, I'm going to go fucking execute my hero today? Or, you know, or I'm in Dimebag's case, it wasn't that. It was a fan thinking that he was responsible for splitting Pantera up because he wouldn't work with Phil Anselmo again. And so, you know, there's issues there, but like in Lennon's case, who, you know, I'm one of your biggest fans. I mean, I'm going to execute you tonight. I mean, it's just insanity. It's, you know, and I watch, it's not that I'm trying to get a better understanding for these people, but I watch a lot of like FBI stuff and shit on how they're trying to get into the heads of these people. And you're just like, I don't know. You never can realize, or you can never fathom how somebody thinks like that, man. It just blows me away. And I guess that's just us as human beings on the right side of things. We don't have that part in our brain that makes us do that. It's the select few that just have this trigger. And it's just, I don't know, man. I'm speechless about it. When am I ever speechless?
Yeah.
And I didn't even make a point there. It just, I rambled on about
about
people murdering and executing people.
Yeah, and I mean, I never really. I'm not gonna lie. You know, I'm not a fan of Pantera. I don't know their music. I'm not a fan of the type of music that they play.
I know they're huge, man.
And I know it was a huge loss, man. Pantera is fucking huge, and they are they're a powerhouse, man.
They were already broken up, and this guy clearly blamed Dimebag for the breakup. But Dime and Phil just, you know, they were look, they were childhood friends, man, and the band just didn't work out. It you know, Phil had his drug issues, so they moved on from him. You know, Vinny and Dime started this other band, and which is, you know. That's the progression of things. But I got to touch on also how unique of a player he was. When you listen to a Pantera song and you hear the opening chords of that song, you know it's Pantera. You listen to an opening chord of a Tool song, you know it's Tool. That's how unique Pantera was and what they brought to the metal world. And Dime, not only was he a huge, huge fan of the gods like Eddie Van Halen, Ace Frehley, you know, Randy Rhoads, you know, but he was admired and loved by some of those same people who were still with us at the time of his death, Eddie Van Halen, Ace. I mean, he was buried in a Kiss casket, for Christ's sakes. If I'm not mistaken, I think he was buried with Eddie, one of Eddie's Frankenstein guitars.
I believe so, yeah. And he had, it was the one that I believe it's the actual one that is on Van Halen 2.
Oh, wow.
That you see on the cover or the back cover of Van Halen 2.
So, I mean, he was admired by these, you know, and looked up to by other, Zakk Wylde, you know, from Black Label Society and Ozzy's band, just was, you know, at a loss over losing this guy. I've had the opportunity to see Pantera live, and what a fucking show. The guy just was a constant constant mover, man. Loved his booze. But you know, he was a partier. He was always the last one to bed, man. He out partied everybody. And it was just a tremendous loss in the metal world to have a guy like that taken from you. You can't compare death to death. You know, they all suck. But you're doing what you love, for Christ's sakes, on the stage in a fucking club, and some guy comes and shoots you. I don't know, man. It's just fucking mind blowing to me.
And just to mention, you know, that there were some other victims. That there was three other people.
We gotta be fair.
Yeah. So yeah, there were, you know, there. I guess one was a crew member, and one worked for the club.
I think it was a guy. Third guy was a fan, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, one was a fan.
A fan of the band, right?
Nathan Gray. I'm looking at that. I just looked it up. Man, I wanted to have something in front of me because I don't know the details by heart the way I know Lennon's details.
Sure. And I don't know. I mean, you're going back some time, but what city was that?
This was in Columbus, Ohio. Nathan Gray, 23 years old. Crew member Jeff Mayhem Thompson was 40, and club employee Aaron Hulk, 29. So yeah, man, this was definitely one of those. This was about a year after the station fire at
the Great White.
Yeah, Great White Station Fire, where, you know, obviously a lot of people died in that, but this was, I mean, obviously that was just a completely different circumstances, but this was somebody that just walked into a nightclub and just opened fire, man.
He was a predator. He was a predator. He was stalking someone. He stalked his prey, and you know, like Don was a fucking deer, and he went out and, you know, executed him.
Now, how do we know, again, I don't know the details, how do we know why he did it? Or is it just speculation?
I think that it came out in the news later on that it was over the.
So they didn't kill him. They didn't I thought he died too. In terms of, like, did the police shoot him or like kill him, or did they like, did he not die and they arrested him?
I would have to look back. I don't know all those details.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know that was the root of it, because I think Phil came out and said that, you know, this was a tragedy. And. And maybe even Vinny said it, Dimebag's brother, because I don't think they ever spoke again at that point. I think Vinny kind of just said, I'm done with Phil, and, you know, that's it.
Yeah.
But I thought it was because of the split, the Pantera split, and this guy was in the Phil Anselmo camp and you know, placed a lot of blame on Dime. And I think Phil even... If I'm not mistaken, Phil might have said something that was taken out of context and you know, the guy acted on it. I don't want to speak out of line if that's not the case. And our fans are the best fans in the world, and they'll definitely let me know if I'm wrong.
Correct us if, you know, or if there's something that anybody can add to Pat's point, please do so in the show notes, or not the show notes, just, you know, if you're listening on YouTube,
Facebook,
throw
whatever,
us a comment, man.
I mean, I
encourage anybody to make a comment.
I'm far from a historian. I mean, I just know of the event. I know some of the ins and outs of it, and I know that it was a huge loss for the music world and what he meant to the music world, especially the metal.
I wish more people would throw us comments. You know, if you're listening to the show, you know. But
yeah,
I think a lot of if you're listening to on a podcast app, there's really nowhere to leave a comment.
Right.
But
right.
We do have a Facebook page. You know, we do have
and
a YouTube
Pat's a jackass.
Page.
He doesn't even know what
no,
the fuck
man,
happened.
No, man, I'm just as in the dark as you are about some of these things, you know? I don't pretend to know, I mean, neither do you. We don't know everything about music, man.
we
act like we do, but... I mean,
yeah. Yeah, we could be snobbish.
Yeah, man. I was just looking at... I've been listening to Miley Cyrus's new record because all of the critics are calling it a rock album. And I don't think there's anything rock about it. I think it's a really good pop album. But I was thinking about an article. I did this piece about Miley Cyrus about 3 years ago, and it was called Miley Cyrus from the Eyes of a Rock Snob.
I remember that.
And it was kind of like I did it as an exercise in writing outside of my comfort zone, you know, and not to get into that, but it's just as far as like the rock snob thing, you know, it's kind of like one of these days.
Did she do an album of covers?
No, but there are some covers. There are some covers at the end that are tacked on to the record.
She did a Blondie cover, didn't she?
She did a Blondie cover, and she does a maybe Stevie Nicks. Let me look at it here. I have it right here. She does Heart of Glass and Zombie.
Wow.
The Cranberries.
A lot of Cranberries. Wow.
And she's got this song called Edge of Midnight, which is a Midnight Sky remix, which is basically got Stevie Nicks on it.
Huh.
But it's from the Edge of 17 recording. So
oh, wow.
My point is, you know, I in this review, I wrote this review of Miley Cyrus's last album, Younger Now, which came out in 2017, and a lot of the critics were trashing it as, you know, well, it's an attempt at country pop and this and that. So I kind of dissed all of the dissed. I mean, it's the first time I've ever fucking used that word in my life. I kind of just like, well, I just said, well, all the critics were wrong, man. You know, I said, well, one of the, and I kind of wrapped it up saying, one of these days, Miley Cyrus is going to make a rock album, man. Imagine what Miley would sound like with a really good producer like T-Bone Burnett, man. See if they don't do that in the future and they don't get together in the future and create a masterpiece together. Well, I mean, she kind of did. I mean, she's kind of making a conscious effort to do something rock, you know. And I guess if this is what the current generation of critics are calling rock, man.
Did T-Bone produce it?
No. She went with that guy, Adam Watt, Andrew Watt, man. He's kind of like the it guy. He kind of worked with Ozzy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ordinary. Yeah. So he's very in with the current trends, man. And he's not bad at what he does, man. He's very good at what he does. But I'm just listening to this Miley record, man, and there's just no, I mean, the drums are weak. There's more synth than guitar. The bass is very non-existent, man. There's just very little evidence of a rock band. It just sounds like processed. It sounds compressed. It just reeks of everything like this of millennial pop in the digital age, man. And it's actually a great pop album. That's the funny thing. You know, I like it. I've been listening to it. But my point is that a lot of critics are calling it a rock album. And when you say, like, we're rock snobs, man, I think, yeah, well, I said, man, fucking Miley Cyrus is the Eyes of a Rock Snob. So there you go, man. Jesus Christ, man. I'm fucking talking up. Shut me up already, man.
That's all right.
Anyway, I don't know. I gotta leave it at that, man, because we're pushed over an hour, man. But you got anything else you want to talk about? You want to throw in there, man? Or
no, man. I thought it was an interesting. This was an interesting show. It was a good show. It was a nice retrospect to some pretty big losses in the music world and. Two tragic
stuff that just happened that, you know, we always, every year, you know, we always talk about Lennon and we talk about, you know, like every 10th year we talk about Altamont and then the Who in Cincinnati and obviously Dimebag. But nobody's really, I mean, has anybody put it together that all this stuff has happened in the first 10 days of December? The first week of December, man, there's just this undercurrent of fatalism that has just haunted the fucking holiday season, man, in terms of, you know, rock and roll, man. But that said, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge that as we kind of wrap up what most of our year has been about, this tragic flaw of the universe, of humanity, of the civilizations that humanity creates, and all the natural wonders that still leave us wondering at the eternal mystery of it all. Just what the fuck is going on here? You know, 2020 was awful to a lot of people, man. Many people found their way back to parts of themselves that were once abandoned, in some cases never discovered. Well, we're going to do it one more time this year, Pat. You know, we're going to do it one more time, but rather than having our usual Christmas blowout.
Don't spoil it. We're not going to have the Christmas blowout, but
no,
I don't think,
man,
we should spoil it.
We usually do that. We usually play music. It's going to be something a little bit different this time.
Nice. That's what I like to hear.
But it's going
to
be a big surprise, especially to the diehards who have listened to the show since the beginning. I think a lot of people will probably get a kick out of what we're going to do.
I like it. I like it a lot.
It's only rock and roll, but you like it.
Yeah. I am looking forward to it.
Thanks to all who continue to support the show. And a nod and a wink to you all. That's it. Peace, love, rock and roll.
Talk to you soon.